The fact that the world we live in privileges some people more than others is just that, a fact. Facts are harder to come by when tracing the origins of autism. A rare diagnosis just 40 years ago, today autistic people are one of the largest minority groups in the world. That fact comes from the CDC, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Our guest today says treating autism only as a disease and a disability ignores the bounty of neurological diversity. It turns out that great minds actually don't all think alike. His TED Talk on the subject was so popular it was translated into 13 languages. His articles have appeared in Wired, The New Yorker, and many other publications. His new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity, comes out in hardback this week. Steve Silberman, welcome to the show. We're so glad you could join us.
Hey, thank you, Emily. I'm very honored to be here.
Oh, we're honored to be speaking with you. Steve, you're best known for your writing in Wired magazine. How did you first approach the subject of autism?
Well, yes, that's interesting because I got into the subject of autism in a very unusual way. Most of the books that have been written about autism were written either by clinicians or researchers or parents of autistic kids, or in some cases, autistic people themselves. But the way that I got interested in it was in 2000, I believe it was, I was on a boat in Alaska with more than 100 computer programmers. And it was an effort to launch a series of quote-unquote geek cruises. And so the sort of the star geek on the boat was a guy who had invented one of the first open-source computer programming languages, Perl. And just before the boat got back into port in Vancouver, I asked the guy, Larry Wall, if I could come interview him at home. And he said, yeah, sure, I should tell you, I have an autistic daughter. And back then, like most people, I didn't know that much about autism beyond Rain Man, so his remark registered, but I didn't make much of it. And then a few months later, I was writing another article for Wired about a very technologically adept family, the patriarch of which had built the first computer in the Middle East. And I asked the sister-in-law of the woman that I was profiling if I could come interview her at home. And she said, yeah, sure, I should tell you, we have an autistic daughter. And I thought, wow, that's an odd coincidence, because at the time it was believed that autism was a very rare neurological condition. And so I was telling that story to a friend of mine at my neighborhood cafe here in San Francisco, and a woman at the next table interrupted and said, oh my God, do you realize what's going on? I'm a special education teacher in Silicon Valley. There's an epidemic of autism in Silicon Valley. Something terrible is happening to our children. And so when she said that, I got this kind of a chill, and also because I'm a science reporter, I got the urge to look into it and, you know, find out if what she was saying was true. And I ended up writing an article in 2001 called The Geek Syndrome, which was one of the first mainstream articles to look at the prevalence of autism in high-tech communities like Silicon Valley. And it got kind of a tremendous response, even though it came out at a very bad time. It came out just a couple of weeks after 9/11. But even so, I ended up getting just a ton of email about it. And the unusual thing was that, you know, most magazine articles are kind of ephemeral, like snowflakes. And, you know, they pop up, they go away, nobody remembers them. I kept getting email from families, from autistic people themselves, from relatives of autistic people, for like 10 years after the article came out. And what I noticed was that even though at the time I wrote it, society was kind of obsessed with arguing about whether or not vaccines were causing autism. By the time 10 years had gone by, even the families that had been very interested in that question originally were now dealing with a completely other set of issues, which was that their kids were, quote-unquote, aging out of services because the few services that are provided to autistic people and their families often run out when the kid graduates high school. So even if they had been very, very interested originally in the question of what had caused their kids' autism, by the time a few years went by, they were wrestling with a whole other set of issues, which are really the issues that families are wrestling with all the time, including, you know, I know a lot of parents who have had to sue their local school boards to get their kids into classrooms. Families are really wrestling with very, very difficult day-to-day issues of helping their children thrive, and if they're autistic themselves, figuring out ways of entering the job market, ways of living independently in the community, access to health care, all these really very human issues that have nothing to do with what causes autism. So I kind of ended up feeling like, even though it had been, you know, a kind of a hit story by Wired standards, that I had really kind of blown it, and that the real issue was not, you know, what is causing this rise in autism in very specialized high-tech communities, but what are we not doing as a society to help autistic people and their families? And so that's why I wrote this book.
So you sort of came at it to study an epidemic and discovered that thinking differently simply isn't accommodated, and can that actually, does that become its own disease in some way, the diagnosis of autism?
Yes. The book really traces how dramatically the scope of the autism diagnosis has changed. Something that, you know, people will say in online groups is they'll say, oh my God, you know, in the 1950s, autism was considered extremely rare. But now it's, you know, 1 in 68, quoting the number from the CDC. Well, you know, what isn't said in that sentence or in those alarming graphs of the sort of hockey stick, you know, spike is that the diagnosis of autism has completely changed.
We're going to talk more about that and a whole lot to cover with autism and our guest Steve Silberman on the other side of a short break. You are welcome to join this conversation. That number is 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Emily Curitan, in for Jeffrey Riley today, and we'll be back in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange with science writer Steve Silberman and me, your guest host, Emily Curitan. We're talking about Steve's new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You can join the conversation 800-838-3760 or email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Steve, we just touched on this before the break. I really want to talk more about the time you spent with people who have autism and their families. But first, I'd like to go back into the past, which you do so well in your book, Neurotribes, to talk about the medical history of the diagnosis. Medical histories in general tend to be on the grim side. Could you talk about which models for understanding autism rose in this century, especially one that was first popularized in the United States, and what the legacy of those ideas is?
Well, autism has a very shadowy and kind of twisted history. What the widely accepted timeline of autism's discovery, I discovered, was completely wrong. And what, you know, what Wikipedia and hundreds of textbooks will tell you is that autism was discovered in 1943 by a child psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore named Leo Kanner. And then, you know, sometimes it's added as a footnote that this guy in Austria named Hans Asperger published a paper a year later in 1944 that, you know, is sort of considered a footnote to Leo Kanner's great discovery.
But they were actually very different, right?
Yeah, they were very different. And I discovered that actually that it was really Asperger that discovered in the 1930s what we now call the autism spectrum. It's so interesting how Asperger's work has been diminished over the years, and I'll explain why that happened. Asperger saw more than 200 kids at all levels of ability in the 1930s and early 1940s, meaning that he saw kids who could not speak, who would probably live out their lives in institutions, but he also recognized that autism was very, very broad and had a very diverse range of manifestations. So he also saw autistic adults who were like, you know, chatty professors of astronomy, etc. He recognized that characters with autistic traits were quite familiar archetypes in literature, like the absent-minded professor, etc. And so Asperger had an extremely prescient view of what autism is. In fact, it's pretty much the contemporary view of what autism is. And he even knew, or suspected anyway, that autism was caused primarily by genetics, and in fact by the action of multiple genes that were passed down from branches of the family tree. So Asperger had this unbelievably prescient view of autism. However, he was in a very, very bad place. Ask yourself what was happening in Vienna, Austria, in the late 1930s. Well, what was happening was the Nazis had marched in and claimed Austria as part of their own fatherland, and in fact, the hospital that Asperger was working in was completely taken over by Nazis and was used as a sort of intellectual center for eugenics, which is the horrific attempt to purify the human gene pool of inherited disabilities and disorders. They didn't have a word for autism, but, there was a secret extermination campaign run by not only the Nazis, but by one of Asperger's former colleagues from the hospital against children with disabilities. So Asperger was involved in this very, very dangerous process of attempting to protect the children in his clinic that had this condition that he believed was inherited, to protect the lives of those children from his former colleagues who had embraced Nazism and embraced eugenics. So anyway, flash forward. In 1938, Leo Connor in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins sees his first autistic patient, a guy named Donald T. Well, not surprisingly, I mean, Leo Connor was a very smart guy, but he didn't quite know what to do with this guy, Donald T., because his behavior was quite unusual. And so he ended up sending Donald to his colleague, George Frankel. Well, who was George Frankel? It turns out that George Frankel was Asperger's former diagnostician from the hospital in Vienna. And in fact, Connor had very heroically saved George Frankel's life from the Holocaust and brought him to Baltimore as part of a major effort that Connor and his wife conducted to save the lives of Jewish physicians from the Nazis. So George Frankel comes over from Vienna, starts working for Leo Connor, sees this autistic guy, and in fact, by then, Frankel had been working in Asperger's clinic for 11 years, so he certainly knew what autism looked like. And in fact, Frankel diagnosed Connor's first three autistic patients. And then, you know, by then, Connor knew what the pattern looked like, and so he could do it himself. But the problem was that the model of autism that Connor developed was very, very different and much narrower than Asperger's. Connor, because he was a child psychiatrist and not both a psychologist and an educator, as Asperger was, like his clinic was almost like half clinic, half residential school. So he was very interested in helping the kids succeed in school. But Connor did not have that on the agenda. Connor was trying instead to launch the field of child psychiatry in the United States. And so what Connor ended up doing was he framed autism as a very, very rare form of what he called child psychosis. And he eventually, just within a few years, went from saying, well, it's probably genetic, to saying that, well, there may be some genetics involved, but the true cause of autism is bad parenting and what eventually became known as refrigerator mothers. And so Connor ended up blaming parents for causing their children's autism, which was a horrible thing. It inflicted a terrible burden of shame and stigma on a couple of generations of autistic people and their families. And even worse than that, if you think that parenting is the cause of autism, then what's the recommended treatment? Well, the recommended treatment in Connor's case turned out to be institutionalization. So he would tell the parents to put their kids in an institution and quietly remove their photos from the family album and, quote-unquote, move on with their lives.
Wow.
And so, you know, I wept, I have to say, at several points while writing the book and reading about the institutionalization of these children and what parents were told. You know, it's completely dark. It's horrific. And so notice what happens then. The children become invisible because they're put in institutions. The parents are told literally by their psychiatrists not to talk about the children. The parents are also carrying the burden of guilt and shame because they've been told, and not just once in an office visit, these are parents who were told that they needed 10 years of psychoanalysis. So for 10 years, you know, the psychoanalyst is sitting there with a notebook saying, why do you hate your daughter so very much, you know, et cetera.
So they were saying that in the first, you know, autism can be diagnosed quite young, right? So they were saying somehow these parents had just screwed it up in the infancy of a child and that they needed, that they had the power to fix it if they were just good enough parents.
Well, not just, yeah, I mean, not good enough parents with everyone in psychoanalysis, you know, both uh-huh. both the kids and the parents. And this went on for years, you know, parents who, you know, were struggling economically anyway, ended up having to spend all this money on you know, endless psychoanalytic sessions to find the, you know, the problem in ego development or whatever, you know, that had caused them to inflict this terrible injury on their children. And that's something, you know, I mean, Connor is a very, very mixed figure in my book. In some ways, I really admire him. He saved all these Jews from the Holocaust. It's it was incredible. That was truly heroic. Many of his observations of autism were very sharp, others not so much. Obviously, the refrigerator parenting theory was, you know, one of the worst ideas of the 20th century. But, you know, I don't get the feeling that he was an evil guy. But the problem is that when he came out with his landmark paper on autism in 1943, his colleagues, who were very into psychoanalysis, said to him, basically, if you say that autism is genetic, then there's no hope for these kids. But if parenting plays a role, then maybe our whole field can do something. And Connor, in a sense, you know, conceded to the peer pressure and then started blaming parents. And, you know, he blamed parents in Time magazine. So, you know, he said to Time magazine, these children have been kept in a refrigerator that didn't defrost, you know, and you know, the subhead was diaper age psychos or something like that. And so, you know, he stigmatized autistic people, he stigmatized autistic parents, and he ended up, you know, in a sense, causing two generations of autistic kids to go into institutions. And here's the thing. One of the things that is said to me most frequently is, well, you know, I'm your age, I'm 57. How come I don't remember autistic kids when I was growing up? Well, the autistic kids who could not pass in mainstream society were in institutions and, you know, not being talked about by their families. And then the autistic kids who could pass as weird or geeky or nerdy or whatever were out there without a diagnosis and without the special forms of education and support that can help them. So, you know, once you know what autism looks like, you tend to remember people from your past who certainly would have been diagnosed today, but the diagnosis was not available to them back then, or they were invisible, hidden in institutions.
We're talking today with Steve Silverman, author of the new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You're welcome to join the conversation. How has autism changed your life? Do you know someone who is actually incapable of behaving appropriately in social situations? Has the label itself of autism changed your family? We want to hear from you. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.com. autismcare.org. Now, Steve, we've been talking about what autism looked like to the men who first diagnosed it in the 1930s and 40s. What has autism looked like throughout history? What do we owe to autism?
Well, you know, one of the sort of curious choices that I made was the first chapter of my book looks at a guy named Henry Cavendish, who was really one of the first modern scientists. He lived in the 19th century, and he pioneered many, many fields of science, from chemistry to pharmacy to physics. He was one of the first people who, or actually the first person, who determined the mass of the planet Earth. He did it in his backyard using weights and rods, and he was a completely fascinating guy. However, at the same time, he was also profoundly disabled in a way that his contemporaries had no explanation for. He did not like to look people in the eye. His behavior was extremely rigid. He took the same walk every day at exactly the same time for decades. He wore the same clothes every day. When the clothes would wear out, he would have his tailor create an identical outfit. He ate the same dish at nearly every meal, leg of mutton. He was fascinated with measurement and numbers. In other words, he was autistic. But there was no word for what he was back then. So, his contemporaries used phrases like painfully shy, shy bordering on disease, eccentric peculiarities, etc. So there was no sort of social frame to view Henry Cavendish through until Dr. Oliver Sacks, the renowned neurologist and author, realized, reading a very lengthy biography of Henry Cavendish, that he was a classic case of what, many decades later would be called Asperger syndrome. And so it was Oliver Sacks who actually first pointed out to me that Cavendish was a classic case of autism, but before there was a frame to identify him. So, and I also talk about another very well-known scientist, Paul Dirac. There was a biography of him written called The Strangest Man, because he was a very, very odd person. But once you know what autism looks like, he's not so odd. And he was brilliant. He was one of the fathers of quantum physics. So between Cavendish and Dirac, just those two men who weren't, and I'm not talking about, some kind of vague on the spectrum stuff, like, people say, oh, well, Bill Gates, he's on the spectrum, or Steve Jobs was autistic or whatever. I don't believe it. As a writer for Wired, I interviewed Steve Jobs. I don't think he was autistic. He might have had some autistic traits. Many of us do. But I'm actually quite conservative about what's called retro-diagnosing people. But in the cases of Cavendish and Dirac, it was very, very clear. They really struggled in their daily lives. And to them, we owe really many of the discoveries that helped us invent the modern world, like handheld electronics or computing or the Internet, et cetera. We owe to the discoveries that they made. So it's really impossible to conceive of what the world would be like without their contributions.
So these people were not diagnosed with autism, and we're talking here, we're kind of slipping into a paradigm. It reminds me, we mentioned Rain Man at the beginning, this way of talking about autism where we say, okay, here's an autistic person, and we, some idea of normalcy, are looking outside in on that person's experience. But in the course of your interviews and your research for the book Neurotribes, did you learn something about the flip side of that, about how do, quote-unquote, how does the normal world look to people with autism?
Oh, I actually have a great story to tell about that. One of the first things that I did when I started the research for my book was to go to what was called an autistic retreat called Autreat. And what that was in a college campus in Pennsylvania, about 70 autistic people of all ages and all levels of ability, from people who did not speak at all to people who are very chatty about their subjects of special enthusiasm, got together and on their own terms created a social environment that was comfortable for them. So There was a schedule published every morning, so they would know what, you know, was coming, because autistic people are often made very anxious by surprises. There was no pressure to socialize. In fact, there was a fascinating invention at this conference that had been invented for previous Autreet, of color-coded badges that were different colors depending on whether or not you wanted to be socially approached. So if you were wearing a green badge, it was like, hi, talk to me. I want to talk to you. If you were wearing a yellow badge, it was like, I can talk to people I know, but I don't want strangers coming up to me and, you know, introducing themselves. And if you were wearing a red badge, you did not want to talk to anybody, and you certainly didn't want, you know, a stranger coming up to you and opening a conversation. And, you know, to a non-autistic person, that may seem kind of contrived or something, but it actually cut through a lot of anxiety about, well, should I go and talk to that person or not? It's like you could see what someone was comfortable with and what someone wanted, even from a distance.
And how did you feel at this retreat as a non-autistic person?
Could we go on after the break, actually, because I have more to say about Autreet.
A whole lot more to say about autism, and it sounds like a decade of your life went into this book that comes out this week in hardback, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. We're talking with Steve Silberman, a science writer. We do have callers on the line. Thank you for waiting patiently. We'd love to hear from more of you about your experiences with autism. 800-838-3760 or email jx@jeffnet.org. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange with Steve Silberman on the other side of a short break. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange, where we've been talking with Steve Silberman, author of Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You can join the conversation, 800-838-3760, or email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Steve, you were just talking about attending an annual retreat organized by and for autistic people, and I had asked, how did you feel there as an outsider of a culture that's usually branded as the outsiders?
Yeah, it was fascinating. It was the first time I was in what you might call the neurological minority. And so there were some goofy interactions that I made at first. For instance, I saw a guy the second day I was there, and just to make conversation, I said, hey, man, how did you sleep? And he looked at me and he said, why? And it was a very sincere question, like, why am I probing into his sleeping life, you know? And so autistic people tend to be very blunt and very direct, and sometimes that's mistaken for being hostile or cold or something. But he wasn't being hostile. He just wanted to know why he wanted to know that. So what happened was, the longer that I spent at Autreet, the more I relaxed, because people were not, you know, sort of nurturing these hidden agendas. They were very frank about what they were interested in, what they wanted to talk about, what they didn't want to talk about. Also, the environment was very sort of soothing in a sensory way, because many autistic people have sort of hyper-acute senses. So instead of loud bursts of applause after the presentations at Autreet, people would flap their hands, which did a couple of things. Hand flapping is one of the classic, you know, sort of diagnostic signs of autism. And kids used to get electric shocks from psychiatrists for flapping their hands. However, you know, so this turned a formerly stigmatizing behavior into a gesture of celebration. And so by the end of Autreet, when I came back into the so-called neurotypical world, the mainstream world of non-autistic people, it seemed very loud and filled with people who were, you know, telling white lies and trying to impress each other all the time. And, you know, in some ways it was a lot like coming back from Japan. It's like, you know, in Japan people give each other a lot of personal space, but then, you know, you come back to Brooklyn and everybody's like in your face. And, you know, so I ended up acculturating to the autistic culture that autistic people had created at this autistic retreat.
Steve Silberman, we've got a caller on the line. Wolfgang in Sunny Valley has been waiting to join the discussion. Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, thanks for calling the Exchange. You're on the air.
That's a fascinating subject, and to raise more questions than it answers. But I'm going to sort of try to limit. I I used to know a very, very talented young woman. She was part of a family I was close to, and she was a problem for everybody else. She was autistic, and she was beautiful, and the problem was the people who kept trying to fix her, trying to put her in whatever, this school or that school or that regimen or all of that. So what it boils down to for me is, to what extent do we impoverish our society by normifying or trying to medicate or trying to make people conform to that loud, stupid world that you experienced as you came out of your retreat, you know, because I feel that way. It's too loud. It's too, why do you ask me that, you know?
Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Let's give Steve a chance to respond.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really well put. And, you know, some behaviors that, you know, now we look back and see them, if not harmless, as actually positive. For instance, something that autistic kids do that's sort of classic is called echolalia, which is that, you know, if the mom says to the kid, do you want a drink of water, the kid will respond, want a drink of water, not I want a drink of water. They might even say, you want a drink of water. And so that's a very distinctively autistic behavior. Well, back in the day, and I'm talking about, you know, just really the 1970s, kids would go through endless, very, very brutal training sessions to try to extinguish echolalia because it was believed that echolalia prevented autistic kids from learning. Well, it turns out to be exactly that's the opposite of the truth. In fact, echolalia is a very distinctively autistic way of learning language. So instead of trying to suppress it or punish the kids for doing echolalia, the best thing to do is to encourage echolalia and find ways of supporting that behavior so the kid doesn't get stuck in a rut and expands his or her vocabulary. But that's, you know, a classic example of how just because a behavior was autistic, it was considered, you know, truly bad or truly damaging. And in fact, it turns out to be a distinctive autistic way of learning.
And some of the descriptions in your book, Neurotribes, of these more behavioral interventions for people with autism, for children diagnosed with autism, they're quite disturbing. They remind me of attempts at conversion therapy on young gay people, which is now illegal in Oregon and other states. Could you talk about that a little bit? Are we out of the dark ages when it comes to a behavioral approach to autism?
Well, you know, things have progressed greatly since Dr. Ivar Lovaas, who was the inventor of a still very, very widely used form of behavioral intervention called ABA, or Applied Behavior Analysis. Ivar Lovaas, in the very early days of his research, treated the kids very brutally, I have to say. I mean, he, in fact, launched his campaign of punishment by striking one of the children in his clinic, a girl named Beth. And, you know, he thought that was good because she suddenly stopped flapping her hands or something. Well, anyway, now we understand that inflicting pain on children because of their behavior is no way to treat human beings. But, Ivar Lovaas theorized that these kids were not, in fact, human beings. He said, you know, they have hair, they have teeth, but they're not really people. You have to build the person in the laboratory. Well, you know, looking back on that, it's completely horrific. It sounds like something from Nazi Germany. And so now, you know, there are a lot of therapists out there, some of whom use ABA approaches, but they do more in the direction of what's called positive behavioral support, where they're rewarding kids for doing things that are good, like being able to build their own autonomy and their own sense of right and wrong and being able to express themselves, rather than punishing behavior just because it's autistic. So we are moving forward, but, you know, there's still a place in Massachusetts where kids get electric shocks for behaving in certain ways, and that's horrific.
We've got another email here. This one is from Boyd in Wolf Creek. He asks, why is this conversation so male-centered? What is the percentage of women with autism, and are there women professionals with insight?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reason why the conversation is male-centered right now is because I'm a guy. But I also think that, you know, that in fact, research on autistic women is one of the huge, terribly ignored fields of study that we really need to commit ourselves to as a society. There is a belief among clinicians that autism presents four times more in boys than girls. I'm actually very, very skeptical of that. I think, and that's something that's, by the way, been a part of autism research for a long time. And, you know, some clinicians...
Gender disparity?
I mean, I think what's going on is that autistic girls behave differently than autistic boys, and many of the ways that we have determined to diagnose autism are centered around male behavior. And, you know, I completely agree with that question. Autistic women are terribly under-noticed, and I think under-diagnosed.
Although I would note, besides Dustin Hoffman's iconic character in Rain Man, Temple Grandin, probably one of the best-known advocates for autism, she would have been diagnosed in the era of Leo Kanner and Hans Asperger, right? I'm assuming she grew up living with Kanner's theory of
autism.
No,
do you know what? This is what's so interesting. In fact, she was not diagnosed with autism, and that's the only reason why she did not go into an institution.
Oh, really?
She was diagnosed with minimal brain damage, which was a label that was very, very popular when she was a little girl, and then, you know, it turned out to, you know, be completely specious, so it's not used anymore. But this is, you know, one of the main points of my book is that people say, oh, autism used to be so rare. Actually not. There were all these other labels, like minimal brain damage, attachment disorder. The biggest one was childhood schizophrenia. There was, you know, allegedly an epidemic of childhood schizophrenia in state institutions in the 1950s. If you look at the description of the kids' behavior, they were autistic. They were definitely autistic. So people say, where are all the autistics? You know, in the 1950s, many of them were diagnosed with childhood schizophrenia. So Temple was diagnosed with minimal brain damage, not put in an institution. Her mother was a very, very brave and determined advocate for her welfare and saw to it that she got an education, even though she got kicked out of many, many schools because of her disruptive behavior. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, my child is not like Temple Grandin. You know, my child is flinging poo on the walls or something. You never know. You know, Temple Grandin was a very, very difficult child, if you read her first autobiography, Emergence. And her behavior really adapted to the social world around her once she figured out what she was good at, which was studying animals and designing livestock facilities for them. So, you know, that started out as a kind of autistic obsession that she was criticized for when she was a young girl, and she ended up becoming one of the leaders in her field. But what I wish is that there were more women than Temple Grandin whose names come up when we talk about autistic women.
Well, we're talking a lot about the way the labels for autism have changed over the years, perhaps more than the neurological condition that they stand for, the variety of conditions they can stand for. There's some new words introduced in your book, your new book, Neurotribes. One of them is in the subhead, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. What is this term, neurodiversity, and where does it come from?
Well, neurodiversity is a term that was coined by a woman named Judy Singer, who was a sociology student in Australia in the late 90s, and she was in an online community for autistic people. And neurodiversity was her attempt to create a frame for conditions like autism, dyslexia, and ADHD that were not so pathological, that also recognized the gifts that each of those conditions convey, because autism, dyslexia, and ADHD all convey certain advantages as well as a distinctive set of challenges in day-to-day life that people have to deal with. So she coined the word neurodiversity, which resembles the word biodiversity, which is a very good thing in a rainforest or really any ecological system. If you have a lot of variety of different life forms, then those communities tend to be very resilient as conditions in the world change. Her idea was that perhaps humanity has a lot of different ways of thinking, different kinds of minds, as Temple Grandin puts it, and that instead of seeing that as like an error of nature that we must correct with medication and you know, I'm not dissing medication. It's like some people really need it, and you know, it's a good thing for them. But that's up to every family and every individual to decide for themselves. But before neurodiversity, things like autism were, you know, tended to be looked at as errors of nature that needed to be corrected by any means necessary. And what she wanted to do with the word neurodiversity was to create a phrase that looked at the positive side of these conditions in the same way that slogans like black is beautiful or gay is good had really transformed the public discourse around gayness and blackness.
It sounds like the internet may have been a game changer for a lot of different social movements, but is that the case for autism advocacy?
Oh, it's huge. The internet is one of those things that autistic people would have eventually invented. And in fact, as you see in my book, some people with autistic traits really did help invent crucial aspects of the internet. It's an ideal communication medium for many autistic people because autistic people tend to be challenged by trying to process things like facial expressions or tone of voice or body language when they're interacting in real time with people. But if you can sit at your keyboard and type at your own pace, you can express yourself in a way that doesn't create anxiety. And I have many autistic friends who, if you see them, in a crowded room or something, they look very uncomfortable and very unhappy. But when they get behind their keyboards, they rock.
Well, we've been talking about the legacy of autism and the future of neurodiversity with science writer Steve Silberman. His new book, Neurotribes, is out in hardback this week. It's been met with rave reviews. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.